The following content is provided under a Creative Commons license. Your support will help MIT OpenCourseWare continue to offer high-quality educational resources for free. To make a donation or view additional materials from hundreds of MIT courses, visit MIT OpenCourseWare at ocw.mit.edu.
We're going to spend most of the time on the Corpus Striatum today, but I want to finish the other major part of the basal ganglia, the amygdala, which is closely connected to the basal forebrain. So let's define the basal forebrain. In discussions of aging and human pathologies, you always hear about the basal forebrain because of the degeneration of acetylcholine-containing neurons in the basal nucleus located there, and that will be in the pictures. So let's look at the medial view of the cerebral hemisphere in the rodent, and this is the hemisphere, this is the brainstem, and I just cut off the hypothalamus here and included it here, because remember, in the basal forebrain, the hemispheres are joined at the bottom. Okay? So, to get the hemisphere separated from the brainstem, we have to cut through the basal forebrain, and I cut it right along the midline here. And as I've indicated, basal forebrain structures here includes a collection of structures, including the olfactory tubercle right at the base. You see it in the sections. So here we're in hypothalamus. There's the amygdala in the hemisphere. Now, this is in front of the optic chiasm. And there you see all the basal forebrain, the major basal forebrain structures, plus the septum. We usually don't include the septum as part of the basal forebrain, but it could be. And functionally, it's very closely allied to these structures we call basal forebrain. The other broader term is ventral striatum, which in recent research has proved to be more ventromedial striatum. And I've indicated that the way I've drawn the color here, showing that the medial part of the more dorsal striatum is really part of the limbic striatum. Maybe limbic striatum is a better term than ventral striatum now, but I'd usually use ventral striatum in the book because that is most of the literature calls it that. Okay, so what does it include besides olfactory tubercle here? Well, I've indicated two major structures here. You see the largest one a little further forward here, the nucleus accumbens, gets major inputs from the hippocampal formation and from the amygdala. But the amygdala primarily projects to the more caudal one here. This is where they overlap, and that's the bed nucleus, the stria terminalis, which we mentioned last time. And then I've indicated in blue there acetylcholine-containing neurons that you see in the medial septum. You see them in this diagonal band of cells. We call it the diagonal band of Broca because he named them that area. And then the basal nucleus at the bottom here. And you see the basal nucleus further forward as well. Those are the cells that have this very widespread projection to the neocortex. They project to the most, if not all, of the neocortex. So it was mentioned in chapter 17 when we were talking about brain states. Okay, now one other topic here, kind of abnormal brain connections that we know occur in at least many types of schizophrenia, and the types that don't include abnormal connections appear to have abnormalities, though, in the receptors affecting the same system that we're talking about. I came up with this hypothesis of an early lesion explanation of some forms of schizophrenia back in the 70s based on work in the olfactory system and visual system that I and other people had done. It was inspired by a study of people with temporal lobe epilepsy that had been operated on in order to get the tissue generating the seizures, the tissue in the temporal lobe, removed to cause the seizures to stop. And they found that the patients could be grouped into two types. After they took the tissue out, it included, you know, amygdala and adjoining structures. They found the signs of early damage. But they found that they could be grouped into postnatal lesions that were due to fever, high fever, in infancy, and prenatal lesions due to what we call hamartomas, a prenatal tumor. So that means one group had much earlier lesions. And I've summarized there at the bottom the real basis for this idea, other than the fact of early lesions, and that is that the earlier the lesion, in these other systems at least, the greater the plasticity, that is, more sprouting, more chances of regeneration, so forth. But here we're talking about sprouting. So I just wanted to run through the hypothesis. These are the connections I'm talking about. In green there, I show the very widespread projections of the catecholamines, the monoamine, serotonin, and some acetylcholine axons as well. I was thinking mainly of the catecholamines, dopamine and norepinephrine. And I knew at the time I drew up this hypothesis that there were dopamine abnormalities in prefrontal cortex in schizophrenics, in many of them. Okay, so here I'm showing how the catecholamine axons have these very widely branching axons that go to the amygdala, they go into the basal forebrain and septal area, and they go to the prefrontal cortex. The cortical projections are much more to these prefrontal areas than they are to other cortical areas. And according to that study I was just talking about, both of these groups had amygdala lesions, but one of them had much earlier lesions. And I would predict this kind of sprouting. For one thing, by removing this structure, we've eliminated these projections to basal forebrain and prefrontal cortex. Okay? But we've also pruned these axons, making it likely that they will show compensatory sprouting in other areas. So those two factors together indicate that this kind of sprouting would be expected in the basal forebrain and in the prefrontal cortex. And the question is, okay, what about schizophrenics and early damage? The fact is, a number of schizophrenics, particularly the ones that are the hardest to treat, they're the ones that often are in mental hospitals for most of their adult life, have enlarged brain ventricles. Now, of course, with more drugs to treat them, more of them are not in the mental hospitals because you can alleviate their symptoms with some of the drugs. But this just shows schizophrenia and monozygotic twins, where you have one twin with schizophrenia, the other doesn't have it. And as they often find in these cases, the affected twin has larger ventricles. And we know that larger ventricles can result from early damage. And this is from a study where they had a lot of patients, and they looked at the relative size of the ventricles with respect to the rest of the whole brain. Here it is in normals, and you can see it changes with age. The ventricles do tend to enlarge after age 40. This is for males here. The curves are a little bit different for females. But this was, it's a very significant finding that the schizophrenics have larger ventricles, an indication of early damage. Many of them do have this temporal damage. Now, different studies have indicated, well, the hippocampus is important, the amygdala is important. Sometimes they don't know. But the particular study I'm talking about was more of a natural experiment because the surgeons had actually removed the tissue to stop the seizures. And then they found one group with earlier lesions. So the question is then, did any of these people have schizophrenia? So they checked for hospital admissions for schizophrenic type symptomatology. And they found that the ones with the earlier lesions, the hamartomas, were much more frequently admitted for schizophrenia. It was a fairly high percentage. Of course, there's always a lot of variability in studies like this. Yes. That's a good question. You'd like to know if in studies of epilepsy, of schizophrenics, how many of them have epilepsy. Usually they're kept separate, but I don't know of studies that have just looked broadly at the schizophrenics. I actually have seen some of these studies, but I can't recall at the moment. It'd be worthwhile checking. Okay, and then just to remind you of these widespread nature of these projections, the dopaminergic projections are a little more widespread according to recent studies than they were in the earlier studies where they were seen mainly in the cortex, they were seen mainly in prefrontal areas. Now we know they are also in the more caudal areas, but just less dense. But also we know the basal nucleus projections are shown here. Very widespread. They could be affected too. And note that this is the way they depict the amygdala. And in every case, these four systems of widespread projections all go to the amygdala as well as to other parts of the brain. All right. And this is just to show you binding to receptors for these different transmitters. Various antipsychotic drugs. The blue shows the dopamine, D2 dopamine receptor binding drugs, and you can see very commonly these drugs have a high affinity for those receptors. But there's an affinity for the receptors for the other type of dopamine. So there's two kinds of dopamine receptors studied here. There's two kinds of adrenergic receptors. Some of them, the binding's higher, especially for this big group on the right, and I'm not saying that, what it indicates is that we know if you bind the receptor, you'll reduce the effects of the projections. If the prefrontal cortex is functioning abnormally because of sprouting of these axons, also the basal forebrain, then binding to the receptors will move it more towards the normal. And that could be a reason. Just saying that it does fit. Alright, let's talk about the other part of the basal ganglia, the larger part, the corpus striatum. Going back to these earlier pictures where I talked about the evolution, remember, very early, there was no dorsal striatum. it was more of an olfactory structure, but it was a link between the olfactory inputs and motor control, and that's what evolved into the ventral striatum. And that we also know the outputs of that region go to hypothalamus and subthalamus. They influence the endocrine system and motivational states by these projections. They also have some connections in the midbrain where they can influence fixed action patterns, especially locomotion. The ones to the midbrain are probably influencing all of these basic movement types. Although I'm not saying those were all there at the very beginning. And we also know that I'm postulating that very early this was a modifiable link. So it must have been modified because of feedback of some sort. And we know the feedback in animals, in modern animals, is mostly dopamine systems coming from, in most vertebrates, the hypothalamus, but in mammals and other amniotes, the birds and reptiles, also the skates and the rays. Sharks, skates, and rays comes from the ventral tegmental area. And we know that, especially if you look in fish, where the dopamine feedback comes from the hypothalamus, that a major input to the hypothalamus in those animals is from the taste system. In mammals, it's never been emphasized, but we know taste can be very rewarding and influences the ventral tegmental area cells. The studies of rats have indicated, yes, there are some projections, even in mammals, from that system. That's why I include it when I talk about the afferents of that region in this book. All right. Now, we know that substantia nigra in the midbrain is a major recipient of outputs from the dorsal striatum. We also know that the nigra, the dorsal part of it, called the pars compacta because of the packing of the cells, is where the dopamine axons of the nigra are located. Because the dopamine cells in the midbrain are not just the ventral tegmental area, they're in the, it's an essential projection to the normal functioning of the dorsal striatum. Okay? The ventral striatum gets its dopamine from the ventral tegmental area. Okay? But not the dorsal striatum. The other part of the nigra is called the pars reticulata. It's more ventral. It has projections to systems influencing movement. They go to the spherical folliculus and influence orienting movements. They also go to the midbrain locomotor area. They also project to thalamic nuclei that project to motor and somatosensory cortex. I depict those projections here. Now here, in this slide, I'm showing just the major dorsal striatal components, the caudate and the putamen. So what's in between the caudate and putamen here? I show a space. The internal capsule fibers coming from the cortex. So this picture is more for the larger mammals, where that have an internal capsule that's separating the dorsal striatum into these two parts. If you're dealing with a rat or a mouse or a hamster, the internal capsule fibers sort of come in multiple bundles through the corpus striatum. So it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to talk about caudate and putamen. So often they just call it the caudate putamen or caudoputamen in these little animals. That's so you don't get too confused when you read this literature. But in cats and dogs and primates in general, you have a clear corpus striatum. So that's what I'm picturing here. And in the picture, I'm showing the dopamine pathway in the pars compacta of the nigra, distributing throughout pretty densely to the whole dorsal striatum. And then I show the output from the caudate that goes to the nigra. It's a GABAergic projection. It acts by inhibiting the cells. Okay? And then I also show the projection from the nigra here to the colliculus, nigrotectal tract, that's also GABAergic. And I show it going forward into the medial structures of the thalamus, VM and the ventromedial and ventral anterior nuclei, which project pretty widely to the motor and somatosensory areas. Okay. So then the question is, if the nigra is signaling some kind of reward or punishment to the striatum, giving it some kind of feedback, well, where does that feedback originate? And there are some interactions between limbic system and somatic system in the nigra. There are connections from the amygdala, which I've added here. This is the same picture, but I've added here the more caudally located amygdala and shown that it projects to the nigra. I've also shown here that the lateral hypothalamus projects directly to the nigra also. So it does appear to be a place where the limbic system and somatic systems show some convergence, which may be very important to how this whole structure functions. All right. Okay, in the evolution of this structure, you start out with the ventral area getting olfactory input, but then we know that non-olfactory inputs came in, and that led to an expansion of the striatum, this area here. I show it it's beginning to bulge because the non-olfactory inputs, and we know that that led to some segregation then of the olfactory part and the non-olfactory part. It's what was olfactory became the ventral striatum, and some of it still gets direct olfactory projections, whereas there sensory inputs come into the dorsal striatum. And I'm just showing you here for a rat or a hamster or a mouse, we know the intralaminar nuclei of the thalamus that we call the paleothalamus, the older thalamus. They tend to get multisensory inputs. A lot of them come from the spirit colliculus, for example. They project here. Some of them come directly from the spinal thalamic tract. They project to these intralaminar nuclei. So I just lump them together here, and I show that they have strong projections to the dorsal striatum. They also have some of these axons extend right up into the hemisphere. So we'll see that here. Okay. Then, of course, I'm showing the cortical striatal connection there, and I'm showing the dopamine pathway as well. Okay. This just shows you the same thing from the Brodahl textbook, where he shows one part of the intralaminar nuclei. It's called the centromedian. It's because in primates, that part, which is a caudal part of the intralaminar nuclei, has become particularly enlarged. So in humans, it's very large also, and other large primates. But this is just to say, this isn't just something that happened early in evolution. It actually enlarged in more recent evolution, as this one nucleus gets mixed non-olfactory inputs, projects strongly to the dorsal striatum. Okay, and this just shows you pictures of what that looks like. I have just one picture in the book. I have three here. This shows in a rat the parafascicular nucleus, which is like that centromedian of primates. And you can see the widely branching axons terminating in the striatum. And here there's a branch going on into the cortex. It projects a little bit to other structures too. And here's one in the centralis lateralis, okay? A little further forward in the intralaminar nuclei. It's also projecting to both the caudate or putamen. Here they're just calling it one structure, a caudate putamen, and to frontal motor cortex in this case. And here's one that's not in the interlaminar, but it's in another ancient part of the thalamus. We call the posterior group of nuclei. They're outside the areas of the thalamus that project to the primary sensory areas of neocortex. They project to multimodal areas. And it shows, and they get multimodal input, and it shows them projecting, again, to the dorsal striatum and into the cortex. Now, I'm showing you pictures of axons that terminate in both places. Many of the neurons in those structures project to one or the other, either cortex or striatum. But because a number of them project this way, it emphasizes the point I want to make, that they're going to both structures, so in many cases they are separate neurons. Okay, so then with the non-olfactory input, you had expansions of both the pallium and the striatum. Here's the pallium, here's the striatum. Here I'm showing olfactory input going to both. The non-olfactory input into the pallium, we know went through the thalamus, most of it. Okay. And then it also did the same for the dorsal striatum, but not the ventral striatum, where the olfactory input is quite separate. And then, of course, in more recent evolution in mammals, you had this huge expansion when the pallium became a part of it developed into neocortex, and that part is expanded so much. And those earlier outputs and inputs remain, even in modern mammals, when all that expansion occurred. But let's look now at, this is a rodent, and this was the earlier picture. I put this one in the book. If you look at the hemisphere from the medial side, you can picture where the ventral striatum, dorsal striatum, and also the hippocampus are located. So here in the middle section, you see the amygdala area here. Further forward, the ventral striatum down here, dorsal striatum there. And very far caudally, you see a structure related to the ventral striatum. It's really a caudal, it's called the caudal amygdaloid area, sometimes hippocampal amygdaloid area. It's very far caudal. It's right next to the hippocampus, which is in here. Okay, so that just gives you the picture of these subcortical structures of the embryo. Okay. So now we want to answer these kinds of questions. What are the two major outputs of the corpus striatum? Most of them are by way of the globus pallidus. We just deal with those coming from the globus pallidus. One of them is much larger in mammals, which is why we sometimes talk about the extrapyramidal system projecting directly to the pyramidal system. Okay? Because the extrapyramidal system are the striatum, the cerebellum, and many other structures that aren't part of the corticospinal system, which goes through the pyramidal tract. So let's look at that. This one, you can guess at the answer. Contrast the major source of sensory input to the striatum in amphibians and in mammals. Now, just of the striatum. What is the big change that happened in mammals? In general, in the forebrain, what was the big change in mammals? Expansion of the neocortex, right. The evolution of the neocortex that expanded. That happened in mammals. It didn't happen in the amphibians at all. Amphibians have this little dorsal cortex that's equivalent to a parahippocampal area. And they have a medial pallium. Okay. But none of it's like neocortex, really. Okay. Even though it does get some non-olfactory input. And then I'm asking what a question that we've pretty much been answering. What's the limbic striatum? How does it differ from the non-limbic striatum? And what are several structures that it includes? Well, I'm really asking what are the components there of that ventral striatum. So we've shown it in some pictures, and we'll look at some more. They're just major parts of it, which recur in the literature and discussions, including discussions of human pathologies, so that you should begin to learn a few of them. All right. This is a simplified diagram of major outputs of the neocortex. And here, I show that striatum is one of the major outputs of neocortex. So if you compare now amphibians and mammals, we said amphibians don't even have a neocortex. So how is their dorsal striatum getting input? Coming from the thalamus, the older parts of the thalamus. Okay? It's the major part of the thalamus in those animals. Whereas in mammals, the major input to the striatum, even though the striatum is still getting thalamic projections, as we pointed out, now the neocortex is by far the larger structure, and it dominates the dorsal striatum, as it dominates a lot of systems because of its size. So this shows the cortico-striatal connection. I show it connecting to the limbic membrane as well. And here I've just included, as part of the limbic membrane, the ventral striatum. We'll separate that in a minute. But note that besides the striatum, the neocortex bypasses even the brainstem for its long connections because it has corticospinal connections. So I have it here going to brainstem and spinal cord directly. Whereas the striatum has a connection to the brainstem, relatively smaller, none to the spinal cord. Okay? But in mammals, it does have a major connection back to the thalamus, which then goes to the motor and premotor areas of cortex. So that's how the striatum is influencing movement, primarily. Some by its connections to the midbrain, but then also much more through the thalamocortical connection, which affects the neocortical output. Okay. So it leaves out the ventral striatum, so those earlier stages of chordate evolution are just left out. And so I've made a more complex diagram here that will drive you a little crazy, but what I've simply done is separate the somatic and limbic systems. If we just want to say, well, what's most unique on the somatic side, what's most unique on the limbic side? What's the most unique thing about the somatic diagram here? It would be this long connection directly to spinal cord. You don't see anything like that from the limbic system. The longest connections of the limbic system go into the midbrain, as now showed, and they're much weaker. I didn't even show it here. It's a relatively weak projection. It just shows where the limbic midbrain is. Okay? Most of the connections are shorter for limbic system. So that's a major difference on the two sides. Another difference is in the diencephalon. Somatic system, the connections are to and from the thalamus. The limbic system, connections to and from the hypothalamus. And then in the striatum, dorsal striatum for somatic system, ventral striatum for the limbic system. All right. The older picture of this was when we talked about the lateral and medial forebrain bundle. And you can see where the dorsal striatum is in these older pictures. Right there. And then these more ventral and ventromedial structures are ventral striatum. Okay, and they connect through the medial forebrain bundle. Whereas the dorsal striatum and neocortex, they connect to more caudal structures through the lateral forebrain bundle, which, remember, the most rostral component of the lateral forebrain bundle is the internal capsule and the white matter of the hemisphere, which we're on that side. And this just is from an old slide. So we can take these pictures, and like this one, and make it much simpler to talk about the striatum. This is one based on a simplification of one of Dodal's pictures. Shows cerebral cortex getting input from thalamus and projecting to the striatum. I don't show the corticospinal projections in that. I'm just showing the striatum here. And then we see its major outputs. And here, by including the pallidum, we show the major connection going to pallidum, but some connections directly to the substantia nigra. Those are the two main connections of the dorsal striatum. Okay. So the pallidum, its biggest projection is to the thalamus. So that information is going to neocortex. Okay. But it also has projections to the caudal midbrain. And here we're talking mainly about that midbrain locomotor region. Okay. The literature names it pedunculopontine nucleus, and Nauta always called it by its full name, nucleus tegmenti pedunculopontinus pars compacta, because it was one part of that compact cell part of that region where the striatum had its main connection. But I use often the functional terms, the locomotor area, because it's a major part of that area which, when stimulated, leads to locomotion. Here I just call it the caudal midbrain. And similarly here, the other area that the striatum projects to, substantia nigra with its dopamine projections. And here its connections to major structure for the other major midbrain structure of motor control, the spirit colliculus. For orienting and escape movements. Okay, so the nigra can modulate those kinds of movements through this connection. This term occurs in discussions of human neuroanatomy, so you should know what it means. It's one of these connections. It's this one, okay? That's the onset. And let's find out why it's called that. It means the handle of the lenticular nucleus. We've not used lenticular nucleus before in the class. We've not used ansa before. But it's the handle of the lentiform nucleus. Here is a picture of the human brain. Okay, and here's, of course, all cortex. This is the neocortex that's hidden in the depth of the Sylvian fissure. There's the Sylvian fissure. Okay. And there's the corpus striatum. There's the caudate up there. Here's the internal capsule. And on the lateral side, we have the lentiform nucleus, which is the putamen plus the two segments of the corpus pallidus. Okay. Thalamus on the other side there. This is where the internal capsule is already going along the side of the thalamus. Okay, the output of the globus pallidus here that goes to the ventral anterior nucleus of the thalamus follows this sort of a hook or a handle, just like the handle of a cup. And that's why it was called the ansa lenticularis, because this group of nuclei, the corpus striatal, dorsal striatal structures, are called, is often called, referred to as the lentiform nucleus. Okay, and what they're doing is going around the edge of the cerebral peduncle here, and then going back forward and into the ventral anterior nucleus. Primarily, they go to VL as well. But VL is dominated more by cerebellar input. The VA is dominated more by the striatal projections. Okay. This just shows you, if you want to see one of Nauta's pictures, which are more complex than the ones like this that I've used, but he does show the projection from the motor areas of cortex to the caudate putamen, which then projects to the globus pallidus. And here are the two projections, caudal midbrain and thalamus. And there's the curving pathway, the onset lenticularis. Okay. So when you hear the term satellites of the striatum, we always mean two structures that are essential for the way the corpus striatum functions in mammals. The substantia nigra, and one other structure that so far I've not named, but it's part of the subthalamus, the subthalamic nucleus. Okay? So I want to show those structures in a network diagram. But first, look at, these would make good homework problems, but I think you can figure them out. Contrast the pathway to motor cortex and the pathway to spherocleculus from the dorsal striatum. Well, the one to the motor cortex we've described here. So, from dorsal striatum through that onset lenticularis, so dorsal striatum to globus pallidus, and then directly to the VA of the thalamus, which then projects the motor cortex. The one to the colliculus goes directly from the dorsal striatum to the nigra. And the nigra projects to superior colliculus. Those are the two different pathways. And then you need to know what we mean by double inhibition. If we look at here we're just looking at one of those satellites, the nigra, and notice excitatory input from cortex. The output is inhibitory. Inhibits the globus pallidus and inhibits the nigra. But then note that the projections of the globus pallidus and the nigra both are inhibitory. So you're inhibiting an inhibitory pathway. That's what we mean by double inhibition. Important for understanding the pathologies when something goes wrong with these structures. As in Parkinson's disease, as in Huntington's chorea, and other basal ganglia disorders. Okay? Because you can get not just a reduced function, you can get enhanced function. Too much excitation. So then, to control it, you need some way to reduce, either replace the misconnections or reduce the overexcitation. Okay, so this is where we'll come back next time. Just point out a couple things about this. This is the worst diagram in the book, probably. But it's been important for people to see how knowing these connections explains some of the disorders. So we'll leave it here, but just note, this is subthalamic nucleus. Here's the nigra down here. So these are the two main satellites of the corpus striatum, caudate and putamen here. And note, I put excitatory connections in blue, inhibitory connections in red. In the red, I didn't color the dopamine pathway here from the nigra. But note, the subthalamic nucleus is getting inhibitory connections from the globus pallidus, but it excites both segments of the globus pallidus and the nigra. Okay? So it's unique in that way, and it's critical for the balance of this system. Okay? So anything that goes wrong with subthalamic nucleus can cause major problems with movement. Okay, so let's stop there today.